We began Romans 11 last week, and in our introduction to that chapter, we considered again the distinction between the identity of Israel per se and the phrase, the people, his people, God's people, the people of God. The reason that this question, has God cast away his people, comes up is because in verses 20 and 21 of chapter 10, he is telling us of Israel's stiff-necked, hard-hearted, willful disobedience and contradiction. Whenever God would say something, they'd argue about it or argue with him or just deny it and contradict it. So that notion that Israel was acting like that automatically raised the issue of God's response. So last week we were talking about that response issue, and there is a distinction between Israel and the people of God. Now, it's true that in verse 1, in his God forbid answer, Paul says, I also am an Israelite of the seed of Abraham, of the tribe of Benjamin. So he is talking about Israel in a sense when he says his people, but there's a bigger sense that was built for us back in chapter 9 about where God had said, because Israel didn't want to have anything to do with God, he said that he would take people who had been called not my people and call them my people. And that he would be revealed to a people who weren't looking for him, and he would make them his people. And those people that he was talking about there were Gentiles, not Israel. So that the his people concept is bigger than Israel, but it's smaller than Israel too in another sense. And so last time we were talking about the distinction. This is an old theme because in the beginning of chapter 9 he said, not all who are of Israel is Israel. So he was making these hairline definition distinctions that I get a lot of flack over. I got it from Paul. He got it from Jesus. So be careful how much flack you dump on me. But the distinctions are very crucial because the issue for Paul is God made some specific promises to some specific individuals, and for the fulfillment of those promises, there has to be some very deliberate divine activity. And he said in Romans 9 that the true Israel are those who are the result of his promise. In other words, they are the people of promise. If they believe the promise, that indicates that they're a part of God's initiatory action in generating faith and causing this promise to be able to be fulfilled, because fulfillment of promises depends on the details of all working together, and God's involved in all that process. So just because they descended from Jacob, who was renamed Israel, doesn't make them the true Israel, and that's the distinction. There is a group called the remnant, and that is the true Israel. It's the people of promise. But Paul in Romans 11 is going back to that idea when he talks about his people in contrast to the verse 21 of chapter 10, Israel, who is disobedient and gainsaying, because there's no way that God did not shove those people who are disobedient and gainsaying away, just like they shoved him away. That's the castaway verb. That means to push them back so they can't do the thing that they would do if you allowed them to get close enough. There's no question that God did that with Israel. AD 70 was proof that he had raised the hand of protection off the nation and let them eat the fruit of their way. And it was disastrous. But not the remnant. The remnant had been warned. But the question was raised last time as to why Paul would repeat this, and the answer is because there is something absolutely crucial regarding the issue of divine integrity that must not ever be lost sight of. There are lots and lots of people who get really disappointed with God because they were told by somebody that he said something that they tried to trust him to do, and he didn't do it, and so they said he lied, or his word's not true, or there isn't any God, and on. I mean, people get frustrated with God over lots of things, but the main issue is this one, whether he really means what he says. And, of course, that raises the question of what did he mean when he said what he said. You got to identify His true meaning before you can hold Him to it. But you don't have to worry about holding Him to it. He's going to do it. You don't have anything to do about that except respond to the fact that He's said what He said. But this is a big deal, a big, big issue. At the end of the day, if, and that's a big if love exists in its divine form, I mean, if God loves and those who are His people love in the same way, if this love exists in the heart, and what I mean by love is, this is the agenda word. When God values something or someone or however you want to say it, it's an agenda issue. Agape is the agenda. It's the objective. What are you going to accomplish here? What's the valuable thing? If this exists in a person's heart, whether it's God's or some human person, when it comes down to the human person, the only real issue that's left, if you want what God wants, the only issue left is the issue that we talk about in terms of faith, and that is whether the way He tells you to approach this agenda accomplishment will actually work. That's the question. When He talks about the promise of eternal life, and in the nitty-gritty of that, He says, don't exalt yourself, don't try to promote yourself, deliberately put yourself under everybody else's need. He says you'll get life if you do that. But most everybody says, that's slavery. I'm not going there. There's no life there. Well, that's just flat out unbelief. And He doesn't lie. So the real issue is not the agenda issue if the love's there. The issue is, well, can I trust Him? And that's the faith issue. The undergirding issue of faith is this issue. Does God have the kind of integrity that makes Him credible? Can you believe Him? And all of us say very piously, yeah. But it's not that easy. So, if Paul really wanted his readers in Rome to actually believe God in such a way that they would be willing to abandon their own methods of life. Everybody has methods of life. But if you want God's life, you have to abandon your methods for His. If Paul really wants his readers to actually believe in such a way that they'll be willing to abandon those methods, he's going to have to tackle the issues that have the capacity to erode this notion in the hearts of the readers. And if God can cast away His people, then you don't have anything to believe. I know a lot of folks who argue that, you know, if you're bad enough, God will kick you out. He'll toss you away. He'll take the salvation He gave you and revoke it. And all, I've heard people say all that stuff. But every time they say it, there is this self-righteous attitude that they're not even aware of, that is saying in effect, but I'll never do anything that bad. God will never disown me because I'm better than that. Well, I've got news for you. If you think you're better than that, you're going to run into the fact that you're not, because God's got to show you that. So, you know, that self-righteousness is a crock. And the problem is, when God shows us how bad we are, our faith begins to shake because it was built on us rather than Him. And the real issue is, can I trust Him? And the answer is, if you're trusting Him, yeah. But if you trust yourself, forget it. Now, one of the issues in this integrity thing, and particularly in this casting away of the people, because it comes out right up here, and actually verse 2 is our focus of study, so this is just a long introduction. But you'll notice the questions here and then the declarations here, in addition to the declaration, God forbid. Has God cast away His people? God forbid. God has not cast away His people. So the thing that's causing this is the behavior of this disobedient, gainsaying Israel. And it is a fact that by the time Paul wrote this letter, there was a major shift by God in his actions. And it is the shift in action that creates the greatest challenge to the issue of God's integrity. Because anytime there's a major shift by God in his ways, there's a problem of how people are going to handle the subsequent problem of the absence of those former ways that they had become very comfortable with. For example, when Jesus was walking on the planet, if you were in Israel and you had a problem, you could take it to him and he'd fix it. He never turned anybody down that I ever read about, unless he said something they didn't like and they walked away. But I mean, if you were a leper, you could get cleansed. If you were blind from birth, you could get your sight. If you were lame, you could get your leg fixed. If your arm was withered, you could get it restored. If you had an issue of blood for 12 years, you could get that fixed. If you were possessed by a legion of demons, you could get that fixed. When Jesus was on the planet and things were happening like that, all of the people in, particularly in Galilee, but in Israel, kind of got used to the idea that this is the way Jesus acts. Then he's gone, because they killed him, and then he rose, and then he ascended, and he's gone. And his disciples take over, and lo and behold, if you're lame from your mother's womb, you can say to Peter, Peter, and he'll say, and jerk you up, and you'll be jumping and hollering and walking, and even if you're dead, they could raise them from the dead. And they healed and they cast out demons and they did all this stuff. And they said, okay, this is the way God acts. And then along comes the fact that God isn't acting like that anymore. And people say, uh-oh. The shift in actions, does this mean that his integrity is broken? And the answer is no. There's no connection between his actions and his integrity except as this whole thing is informed by his promise or promises and his meaning for them. There is only a breakdown in God's integrity if what he said he doesn't do. That's the only time the actions threaten the integrity in reality. But the problem for most people is they don't want to recognize that God sometimes shifts his actions because they're outside of the boundaries of his promises. God does a lot of things that he never made any promise about. And one of the big things he didn't make any promises about in relation to the his people thing was the shift from national Israel as a focus of attention to the international church. As far as we can tell, there's nothing in the Old Testament about any such kind of shift. God didn't say anything about an international church. He didn't say anything about taking a bride for his son out of every kindred, nation, tongue, and tribe. He didn't say anything about that. So when he shifted to do it, some people thought that his abandonment of national Israel and the focus on national Israel, especially from AD 70 on, indicated that God had cast away his people and therefore the whole issue of faith was thrown up into the air. You can't trust him. He might just change his mind. Well, it wasn't his mind he was changing, it was his actions. And you say, well, why did he shift from national Israel to the international church? Because the plan has multiple big-ticket issues. And to get them in place, he has to do some things from this direction. And then he has to kind of leave off that and come at it from this direction. And then he may have to leave off that and come at it from this direction. And then he may have to live, you know. The master plan has to do with Israel becoming a believing nation so that it can inherit the kingdom. But it also has to do with providing the king of the kingdom with a Gentile bride, basically an international body that's going to be his queen. It has to do with a time of great judgment of the world, called the time of Jacob's trouble. And then it has to do with the reign of the Messiah on the earth, where nobody can see or enter the kingdom of the Christ without being born again. And all of these are big ticket issues that are involved in the plan, and every one of them takes a special focus by God, so that for 1500 years he was focused on Israel, and then he shifted to the church, and it's the focus on it. It's been around now for almost 2000 years. We know the world judgment issue is going to be a 7-year period. And the church isn't even going to be in play at that point, because they're going to be out of here. And the reign of Christ is a whole different issue. So what I'm trying to say is, what Paul was dealing with in Romans 11 was that God had shifted in a major way his actions. And people were saying, does this mean that you can't trust him? Well, only if the actions represented a breakdown in his promises, and they didn't. He didn't promise to do and then quit doing. He just started doing some things he hadn't addressed with promises or otherwise. And the shift by God represents this challenge to his integrity. People get comfortable with the way God is dealing with things, and then suddenly he throws a monkey wrench in it. It doesn't have anything to do with a breakdown in his promise. They just got used to the way he was dealing with them. He didn't promise he'd deal with them that way. That's just the way it was. I can remember this happening to me. I've told you about it, but I'll just remind you. For years, as a new believer and as a growing believer and as a participant in issues of ministry, I always had this pattern that God had in place when I could tell that he wanted me to make this decision or that decision or whatever. So when we were faced with a decision, we'd look for the pieces of the pattern. Well, time came when I felt like it was really necessary to make a change, and I was praying about it, and I was wondering, you know, I'm looking for these things of pattern. And on the way to another town on the highway, as I was praying in my car, the verse of one of the Psalms, I will guide you with my eye upon you, just popped into my brain, and it was so there that chills actually went down my neck and spine, because when that verse popped into mind, I knew with as much conviction as I could have that God was telling me, Daryl, the pattern's going to change here. I want you to stop looking for things that you can trust that tell me that you can trust me, and I want you to start trusting me. I told you I'd guide you with my eye upon you, now believe me. Whoa! And from then on, it's been a matter of, okay, I got a decision to make. I can't go looking for the indicators. I have to say, okay, God, you said you'd guide me. I'm going to trust you to guide me. We're not comfortable with that. We don't want to have to grow up. We just want to get comfortable and stay there. And God says, I ain't interested in how comfortable you are. I'm interested in how much you grow. So this is the issue. So this evening, in the time that we have left, we're going to plow some of this old ground that we've already talked about, and the fact that God has not cast away his people, but we're going to deal with it from this little phrase, which or whom he foreknew. Now this foreknow is old ground, especially for those of you who are in our study on Sunday night, because we just got through talking for 2 or 3 weeks about the foreknowledge thing. So I realize that we're going to be plowing some old ground here, but I want us to talk about whom God foreknew, because in a very real sense, that's a redundant word. How can God foreknow when he's omniscient and he's unbounded by time? So we're going to talk a little bit about this, but I'm going to ease my way into it by reminding you of the issue of his people. The His people concept was actually developed in Romans chapter 4. From verses 9 to the end of the chapter, Romans chapter 4, Paul argued that the people of God were those who mimicked the faith of Abraham. And he argued it that they were His people if they mimicked the faith of Abraham, regardless of whether they received circumcision and were under the law or had nothing to do with the law and circumcision. He said, Abraham received the covenant before, or the promise before he got circumcision, so if you believe like Abraham did before circumcision, then circumcision is not an issue. But on the other hand, if you are Jewish and you're part of that national structure where circumcision became the sign of a covenant, if you receive circumcision, you're not automatically one of the people of God unless you mimic the faith of Abraham. So it's the issue of believing that makes you one of His people. It's not whether you're national Israel or part of the international church. It's the issue of whether you believing. That's the thing that makes a person of God. And that means that if a person has believed like Abraham believed, then he's one of God's people. And it doesn't matter if he's a Jew or not. But it also means that what God decides to do in regard to His people as individuals or as a collective group or as a bunch of collective groups of people has really nothing to do with whether He's believable. His integrity stands regardless of how He decides to deal with individuals or groups of individuals, as long as the promise that He made is not undercut by His action. For example, we have some people who tell you that God has made a commitment, covenant commitment to the church for physical healing of anything that ails you, because in James chapter 5 it says that the prayer of faith will raise the sick. In fact, I had some missionaries who were out there on the front lines doing the work asked me about that when I was teaching the issues of the covenants up in Alaska. And the fact is, the terminology in James chapter 5 is a promise that God will straighten out the spiritual issues for the person who's struggling with physical issues and getting derailed by them spiritually. It's not a promise of physical healing. So, the fact is, in the covenant with the church, there is no promise of physical healing. None! Now, does that mean God will never heal you? No. Every time you get well, you've been healed by God. Just because you took an Excedrin or, you know, had a surgery or what, you were healed by God. He's our healer. The tools He uses to do it are up to Him. But He can also let you get sick and die and not have broken His promise to you. Because He didn't promise that He wouldn't let you get sick and die. So that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. God is free to decide what He's going to do with us as individuals or even as a collective group or even in the larger collective group. It's His choice to decide what He's going to do as long as He doesn't violate the words that He's given to us. And so the historical reality of a divine shift of focus from national Israel to the international church or it doesn't have anything to do with God's integrity. His people are people who've trusted specific promises. And as long as God doesn't violate His specific promises, you can't charge Him with being unfaithful. But let me also say this. You can't claim it's His faithfulness when He does something that He didn't promise to do. That's just mercy or grace or goodness on His part. I hear people say things like, well, God is really faithful. He kept us from getting injured in this wreck. And I want to ask them, well, was He not faithful to those other believers that got injured in the wreck? He didn't promise anything about wrecks. He didn't say you wouldn't get injured in one of them. He didn't say you would. So those are the areas where He's free to do what He wants to do, and we're free to give Him thanks. But we're not free to say, well, He failed. He did not. He doesn't fail His people because they believed what He said and He produces for them. Now, the question is, why does Paul bring this foreknowledge thing in at this point. When he said, did God cast away his people in verse 1, his answer was, God forbid, meganoita. That's as strong in the Greek as you can get for a denial. Then he turns right around and says, God has not cast away his people whom he foreknew. Well, what does that mean? He's already asked and answered. Why is he repeating himself? Well, I'm going to suggest to you that the reason is because it's so crucial. The issue of foreknowledge comes into play because it, like nothing else, establishes the constant integrity in the face of the fluid action. The integrity stands on promises given. The actions are fluid. They come and go depending on God's choices and stuff. As long as they're outside the boundaries of what the promise requires, he'll never not do something he said he'd do. He'll never do something he said he wouldn't do. But there are a whole lot of things about your life that he didn't even address. And so he's got a lot of freedom outside here. And in the fluidity of his actions, there is this constant that is rooted in foreknowledge. And I want to explain why I say that, because foreknowledge is a greater concept than most of us understand. Foreknowledge is so central to the issue of divine integrity that we need to understand it as clearly as we can. And our understanding can only develop as we ponder the issues that are involved under a deliberate submission of our minds to God while we're pondering. And what I mean by that is it doesn't do any good to ponder it if you're already in conflict with God over something. If you're not deliberately submitting your thinking and your attitude to God while you're thinking about these profound issues, then you're going to go astray. The deliberate submission of our minds to God is not an automatic event. It's a deliberate act. That's why it's always a very good idea to pray before you study the Bible. Because in prayer, if you're going to be submissive, that's when you'll deliberately choose to be. Now, that doesn't mean you are. I mean, some people go to prayer like they're the commander-in-chief and he's the subaltern. God, do this, do that, blip, 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 blip. Got your orders? Do it. That's not submissive. So, I want us to think about some of the issues. One of the first issues in foreknowledge is the reason for the word in the first place. This is called etymology. We have seen in our generation an explosion of vocabulary in English language because of both the Industrial Revolution and the things after that that have led us into the computer age and all of those kinds of things. There are so many areas of the pursuit of knowledge these days that are so right out there on the edge that we don't even have words to describe them. So we have to make them up. We have to create them. First time a guy built a computer hard drive, whether you know what that is or not, it's immaterial. First time they built one, they had to decide, okay, what are we going to call this? Well, let's call it a hard drive. Why not call it a soft one? Well, because we used to use floppy disks to run the machine. That's where all the program was that ran the machine, that drove the machine. Okay, we'll call it a floppy disk driver. Now we've got a hard disk driver. Well, what's a hard disk drive? Well, it's a round thing. That's why they call it a disk. And it's not flexible, so that's why they call it hard. And it's got the computer program on it that runs the computer, so that's what they call it, a driver. But before you can even sell one of these things to some gullible person that wants a computer that'll do all this fancy, you got to have a name for it. What do you want? Well, I want a computer. Oh, okay. Well, what was that before 1945? Well, what do we want in this computer? Well, I want some RAM, and I want some ROM, and I want some hard drives, and I want some... What? See, all this is new words. Terminology. So when we talk about etymology, we're just talking about why words are coined. And when we ask the question, why was foreknowledge coined? what was the deal that created the need to talk about something called foreknowledge? Words are created by the necessity of communication. The interesting thing about foreknowledge is that it has a word, pra, which is a preposition, and it's wedded to a word, gnosis, which comes from the verb gnosko. I know you're just terribly thrilled by all that. But, you know our word prognosis? Can I write it in Greek? You see this? In English, that's prognosis. Guess where they got prognosis? It's a transliteration from Greek straight into English. What does it mean? Well, what does prognosis mean in English? It means, well, what's the anticipated result? Well, you can't talk about an anticipated result unless you have some kind of knowledge ahead of time as to how these kind of things work. So the prognosis is the statement about what's going to be based on what you already know or have known in the past. So foreknowledge is simply knowledge that's talking about the way things are going to work out in the future based on the fact that you know this ahead of time because you know certain things about it. For example, we all know that caffeine will make you shake if you get too much of it if your body's not used to it. We all know this if we've ever drank too much coffee without being a coffee drinker. What happened? Well, I drank one of those high caffeine things. Well, why are you doing this? Well, that's just the way caffeine works, okay? We know because we know the principles that are involved. We take caffeine plus a non-adjusted body and you dump it in there and poof, all of that stuff that happens. Well, etymology for foreknowledge is just knowledge that you have ahead of time or before now. Now, I want you to notice how in trying to figure out what a word means, you have to start with etymology, but you have to recognize that sometimes this etymological meaning will shift over time. For example, what do you suppose was the meaning of the word BAG when they first coined it? Well, probably a container that you could put things in and carry it. That's a bag. Now, why they came in a bag, I don't know. But that's a bag, okay? Now, what does it mean when I say, that's not my bag? Do I mean, that's not my bag? Or do I mean, that's not something I'm interested in, I'm not, you know, I still go there. That's not my bag. You see how meaning shifts over time? Well, when you're doing etymology, you have to be really careful that you don't force this into your understanding of the present word here. You have to do the next step, and that is use. And particularly use by the same author. How I use a word is my meaning for it, how you use it. And if some third person takes the way you use it and applies it to my sentences, they may not understand at all. So with Paul, one of the first places that we see prognosis, prognosko, one of the first places we see it is in Acts chapter 26, verse 5. I want you to notice, foreknowledge is not even here, is it? Oh yeah, it's right here. Now why didn't they just say, those who had foreknowledge, if they would testify, after the most straitest sect of our religion, I lived the Pharisee. Why didn't they just say that? Well, because that's what Paul was doing here, was he's defending himself in a court of law before King Agrippa. And what he's saying is, my manner of life from my youth, which was at the first among my own nation at Jerusalem, all the Jews know. Now, this is general, but this is all those people that were in Jerusalem when I was in Jerusalem and got to know me and we rubbed shoulders and we debated and we had our classes under Gamaliel. We got to know each other really well. He said, my manner of life from my youth in my own nation at Jerusalem, all those folks know about. because they foreknew me. Well, what does that mean? Well, they knew me back then, before now. And that's what foreknowledge means, to know before the present. That's why it's called before knowledge. Know before the present. And what he's doing here is crucial, because this is Paul's use of the word foreknow. They foreknew me. What does that mean? Well, look at what it means. He's talking to King Agrippa. He's in a court of law where he's going to have to defend himself, and he asks the king to hear him patiently. And his first rattle out of the cage is, I want to start with the way I was living that everybody knew about, and they could testify how I lived if they would. Now, what's that mean? It means those having foreknowledge of me could, if they would, stand as witnesses in a court of law, legitimate witnesses. They tell you the truth. Now, this is interesting because what he's saying is the foreknowledge made it possible for them to stand as witnesses in a crucial setting where truth was absolutely necessary in a court. And how did they get this? Well, because they were with me from my youth in my own nation in Jerusalem. We rubbed shoulders together. We went down to the pub together. We went to Gamaliel's class together. We argued and debated law together. We did all this stuff together, and they found out about me that I was one hard-nosed Pharisee. That's what they found out about me. And if they'd tell you, Agrippa, that's what they'd tell you. If they would come and swear to tell the truth and nothing but the truth, they'd tell you I was one uncompromising Pharisee. In fact, I was on my way to the top of the heap. They knew that. Why? Personal experience of Paul. That's what led them to this. Personal experience. Now, it's interesting that prognosko uses the word for knowledge right here that is experience-based and most intimate. This is the word that's used in the Bible when it says a man knew his wife and she conceived and bore whatever. That's pretty intimate knowledge. It's pretty experiential intimacy kind of stuff. When you have the kind of personal experience that allows you to be a witness in court concerning somebody, that means that you've had plenty of personal experience of them that will enable you to stand in that court, swear to tell the truth, and do it because you know what you're talking about. You've had personal enough experience over a long enough period of time that you can do this. That's what knowledge before means. They knew me before the present to the degree that they could stand as witnesses of me in this court. They could do that if they were inclined. And it's interesting that the only other two times that Paul uses this term are in Romans. If you remember, we ran into this back there in chapter 8. And I want you to look at that again, verse 29. He says, whom God foreknew. This is the beginning of what they call the order of salvation. We know that all things work together for good for them that love God, to them that are called according to His purpose. For whom He did foreknow, He also did predestinate to be conformed to the image of His Son, that He might be firstborn among many brethren. Moreover, and he goes on and on. The point that I want to make here is that the whom He did foreknow is identified. Those that love God and are the called according to His purpose, or the called according to purpose. The His is not in the Greek. The whom He foreknew are these folks. So love for God and being commissioned by God for a task, these are the foreknown. Now what he's saying is that God had a personal, relational knowledge of them before the present. The reason is right here. this knowledge is possible because there is a mutual response in knowledge of this kind. You can learn facts about people, but you don't ever know them until they start letting you know them. And that's a mutual interaction, personal thing. That's why it's always good to date for at least a week before you ask them to marry you. I mean, you know, you want to get to know them. Anyway, the point is, when you have these personal elements involved, then you have this kind of knowledge, and when it's before the present time, then you can call it foreknowledge. Now, the issue for God is strange because he doesn't have to, I don't know how to say this. God's omniscient. He knows everything. There's not anything he doesn't know. So what is this knowing before? Well, I think the answer to that is, let me tell you what I think Paul's concept of foreknowledge actually is. It's a highly prejudiced issue because he uses it first in Acts of people who could serve as witnesses in a court of law and come out with the truth because they've had enough experiential background with Paul to be able to do that. So it's experientially based before the need to declare the truth about him. And then in this text, it's prejudicial because the love for God and being called by him for a specific purpose, those are highly significant personal issues. You can't have an impersonal love, and you can't have an impersonal commission. This is personal. This is something God and you are involved in. And then in the text that we're in now, chapter 11, verse 2, he's already said, they're his people, and this is identified as people who've entered into a one-on-one believing relationship because he made a promise and they took it for themselves as absolutely true. And that brought them into his family. This is very personal. And he says he has not cast away these people because they are foreknown by him. Now, what all that also means, well, there are some other things, but the point that I want to make is there is no point to talking about people God has foreknown unless the issue of the text in has God cast them away. This is a question of whether the relationship is broken to the point where he is done with it, and he says this is not going to happen. But this entire thing is relational. So foreknowledge is fundamentally a relational term. Fundamentally that, relational. It's heavily weighted with a mutual personal involvement concept that requires us to conclude that it's used when the issue is personal involvement in a historically prior setting. Now, let me show you why that's important. Matthew chapter 7, verse 23. In verse 21 of Matthew 7, Jesus is saying, not everyone that says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter into the kingdom of heaven, but he that doeth the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name? And in your name have cast out devils, and in your name have done many wonderful works. And then I will profess to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you that work iniquity. Now what is this iniquity thing? Look at this. He doesn't say, no, you didn't prophesy in my name. No, you didn't cast out demons in my name. No, you didn't do many wonderful works in my... He didn't deny that. This was their claim, and he didn't deny it. He called them workers of iniquity for doing it. How in the world can you do that? How can you call somebody who prophesies in his name a worker of iniquity? Or that casts demons out in his name and call him a worker of iniquity? And do wonderful works in His name and call them workers of iniquity. How can you do this? How can you call them that? One reason, motive. What are they trying to do? They're trying to enter His kingdom on the basis of what they have done. What is that? That's salvation by works. The fundamental bottom line is Romans chapter 10. Israel didn't know about the righteousness of faith, so they ignorantly set about to establish their own righteousness. Why'd they do that? Because they wanted to be able to brag about how they got to be in such a sublime place. Well, I got here because I deserved to be here. That's what you call a worker of iniquity. Oh yeah, you may have prophesied my name, but whose name were you really trying to bolster? Mine or yours? You may have cast out many devils in my name, but whose reputation were you trying to build? Mine or yours? You may have done many wonderful works in my name, but who is going to stand to really benefit from this labor on your part? Me or you? And He calls them workers of iniquity, so we already know who. Not God. But notice the key issue right here. The key issue is, He says, I never gnosko'd you. This is our word for before knowledge without the before. Now, how can God say, I never knew you? I thought He knew everybody. Well, if you're talking about omniscience, there isn't anybody He is not fully. He knows every molecule in your body. He knows every shade of attitude that you've ever had in your whole life. He knows everything there is to know about you. But that doesn't mean He knows you with this word. Because this word is a relational word. And that means that if you haven't entered into a relationship with Him that is mutually interactive, then He doesn't know you. And you don't know Him. And that's how He can say, I didn't know you. He didn't mean, I don't know everything about you. He didn't mean that. He meant, I never had a relationship with you. This is where the foreknowledge issue is so crucial, because the whom He foreknew, He cannot cast off His people whom He foreknew. That Romans 11:2 text says, God has not cast away His people which He foreknew, because, quite frankly, He can't do that and maintain His integrity. If God has ever known me, gnosko kind of knowledge, then He can never say to me, I never knew you. Can He? No, it'd be a lie. Well, if it would be a lie for Him to reject somebody that He has foreknown, and it would be, then His integrity isn't worth a plug nickel. But if, on the other hand, He did know them with this relational knowledge ahead of time, then He certainly cannot cast them away, because His integrity is on the line. We started this off by saying, this is the issue. God's integrity is on the line. If He's ever known you, He will never be able to say to you, I never knew you. So the promise is good. The promise of eternal life is yours if He's ever come to know you. Now, in Galatians, Paul said it this way. I'm worried about you folks. How is it that after you came to know God, or maybe I should say have been known by God, how is it that you turn back to those weak and beggarly things? I'm worried about you. The reason that he's saying that is, it is contradictory to fundamental new birth issues for a person to turn back to the law from God if he was foreknown by God. And of course that means that a lot of people's professions of faith and professions of knowing God, the issue is not whether you know him, but whether he knows you. Because in the final day, he's going to look at everything he's done, and motive is going to come up, and he's either going to say, welcome, I've known you from the beginning, or he's going to say, get out of here, I never knew you. It's all foreknowledge issues, but it's all personal relationship stuff. But I'm still going to let you have your question or comment anyway. Most of you are not in the big rush to leave. Those that are, there's the door. Okay, questions or comments? Maybe we just blew so much smoke in your face that you don't even know what to think. All right, well, let's have a word of prayer together and we can visit with one another. Father, we're grateful to you that you have known us and that that seals our position before you based on your integrity and not ours. We know that your knowledge of us does have some integrity issues that are involved, but they're not fundamentally ours. They're yours. So we pray that as we ponder these things that you'll enable us to grasp them clearly. We ask this in Jesus' name.